Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. This is Joyce Graff and we're delighted to have you with us today. We're going to be speaking today with Dr. C.K. Hirsch, who's written a new book called Conquering the Game of Life. And we'll be back with him in just a few minutes. First, we're going to have a little word here from our sponsor, the VHL Family Alliance.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back, and this is Joyce Graff, and I have with me Dr. C.K. Hirsch from Norfolk, Virginia. Welcome, Dr. Hirsch.
Hey, Joyce. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be with you today.
My pleasure. So I understand you're a hand surgeon.
I am. I'm an orthopedic surgeon that works with the hands primarily.
Right. I'm a two-time carpal tunnel system surgery survivor myself. So, which I did in the 1990s, but so it's great to have a good handman around. So I understand you had a bout with cancer yourself.
I did. I was at age 34 diagnosed with thyroid cancer, papillary carcinoma of the thyroid.
And that's always a shocking diagnosis, even for a professional. Maybe more so for a professional because you know more of the things that can go wrong.
Well, it's kind of funny. The experience, usually I'm the kind of person with being a physician that, you know, you have lumps and bumps or different aches or pains, and you have a tendency to ignore them, you know, knowing that most things go away. And this particular thing, when I felt the lump in my throat, somehow it felt different to me, so I knew that I needed to take a different action and then pursued it.
So, but you came through it okay.
I did. It was an experience. You know, I had its ups and downs, and as a physician, it opened up seeing patients in a different light. So through that, it was a great experience in the fact that it made me, I think, a much better physician than I would have been otherwise.
So how long did you go through various kinds of treatment?
Basically, with the thyroid cancer, initially we did the testing, some blood work, a sonogram, a needle biopsy, and through that, then it was determined that the area of the mass needed to come out, and so I went through surgery where they took out half the thyroid gland, and I'm one of those people that when I get put to sleep, my ears kind of clog up, and you kind of feel like you're underwater for a while or just landed from a jet airplane, might be the other analogy people can relate to. And I'd gotten home and was starting to get over that and made a comment to my wife that, well, I'm glad that's done. I wouldn't want to have to go through that again just because of the airline feeling. Mm-hmm. And then that Wednesday afternoon, I got a call from the surgeon, and he said, you need to sit down, which nothing ever comes good when somebody tells you that. So I sat down, and he said, well, we found adjacent to the mass an area of cancer that signals that we need to take out the other side of your thyroid. So with that was a Wednesday. With that, that Friday, I was back in the operating room and had the other half of the thyroid gland out, and then they determined that it was best to go through radioactive iodine. There was a little debate about whether or not that was going to be necessary. So 6 weeks later, which put it into November, I took some radioactive iodine and then stayed in a, at the time they kept you in the hospital room until the radioactive iodine cleared. And then with that, a couple weeks later, then began thyroid supplementation. And with that, the road to recovery.
So tell us a little bit about the radioactive iodine. What is that? When you say you take it by mouth or it's injected?
It's actually done by pills. They look at the uptake of the of how much thyroid tissue you have left through a study and then determine based on your weight how much of a load they need to give you of the radioactive iodine. And then they formulate a pill, two pills that have that amount of iodine, radioactive iodine in it, and then you take them, and then your body absorbs it. It goes through your bloodstream, and basically any cell in your body that takes up the radioactive iodine gets destroyed. But you have to wait for that to then clear your body before your kind of radiation level goes down to where it's safe to be around other people.
Right. So this seeks out the cell type that they're trying to destroy.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages of having something like thyroid cancer is, for the most part, most thyroid cancers pick up iodine where other cells in our body don't. So it's a nice way to be able to target them and get rid of them.
Right, right. But then, as you say, you're sort of glowing and it's not safe for you to be around other people.
Right. I had my son wasn't born yet, but my daughter was. And so, you know, a four-year-old child in the house, it just wasn't safe to be around. And it also turned out my wife was pregnant at that time. So, again, not safe to be around.
Right. You can't tell a four-year-old not to crawl in your lap.
Right. Makes it a little challenging.
Right. So they kept you in isolation in the hospital for how long?
I think it was about 4 days. The challenging part was that I was still in the Navy at the time, and the room that I was in was on the north side of the building, and it happened to be, as I said, November, and so the wind was blowing, and the heat in that room wasn't that great. And when you're off thyroid supplementation or don't have a thyroid, you become very sensitive to cold. And so the wind was blowing, the thermostat in the room wasn't working right, and they kept bringing me ice water because you're supposed to drink a lot of liquid. So it was one of the coldest experiences I can remember. So
did it have to be ice water, or they just kept thinking you would like it that way?
They just thought I'd like it that way.
Yeah. So, but you have to drink the water to flush it out of your body, is that right?
Right. The idea is to dilute it out as quickly as you can so you can get on with things.
Right. But as cancer treatments go, that's not as bad as a lot of them.
Oh, you're exactly right. There's a lot of things that are more challenging than what I went through. As a physician, the altering part was realizing with how much medical information I had been, you know, given and knew, and yet still the questions that come in your mind as you go through an experience like that made me realize what it would potentially be like without having all that information. And it could be pretty scary, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah. And there's also sort of the medical school syndrome that you can also blow things out of proportion. It sounds like maybe you didn't do that, but a lot of people who are nurses and doctors themselves immediately flip to the worst possible outcomes.
Right, especially in med school, as you're learning about things, as you learn about one particular disease, you notice any of the symptoms in yourself. And then start thinking, oh my gosh, I have disease X or disease Y. And then as time goes on, you learn that, so many of those symptoms, like, just go with nausea. Nausea can be something that occurs in so many different things and is such a vague symptom in that sense that it really, in and of itself, doesn't signal anything necessarily.
Necessarily, but it might be one in the set of symptoms that go with whatever disease you're studying that day and can tempt the medical student to immediately think they have it.
Right, exactly.
Right. So what kinds of things did you learn? What changed in your own behavior with your own patients?
Empathy and understanding. Spending time. Well, as a hand surgeon, you get people that come with hand pain is the reason why they come to your office.
Right.
And when they say, my hand hurts, well, that's a pretty vague symptom, just like we were talking about. And so sometimes if people stay at that vague a level, it's hard for the doctor to figure out what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's that experience got me to become more creative with asking questions to figure out, okay, what does hand pain mean to them? And kind of explore it in different ways and get them to start helping me figure out what their problem is.
So let's role play this a little bit. I'm coming into you with hand pain. How do you go about pinning it down?
Where does it hurt? What part of the...
Maybe you're poking my fingers to say, does it hurt here, there, or elsewhere?
Sure. It's a little hard over the phone, but or over the radio. Basically, as you're doing initially as you're talking to them before you start touching their hand, it's trying to isolate, okay, well, where does it hurt? When does it hurt?
Mm-hmm.
In what way does it hurt? And then if somebody keeps using the word, well, I have pain here, well, tell me about the pain. Is it a sharp pain? Is it a dull pain? What activities bring on the pain? Then as you start touching them, you, of course, touch at different locations and say, you know, does it hurt here? Does it hurt here? With different areas signaling different things for myself of knowing what's there and what might be the problem. And sometimes you go through that and in terms of touching them and nothing hurts at that particular time. So then then you have to start going, well, okay, what activities bring on that pain? And then as they give you some activities, I'd start looking around the room to figure out what things in my exam room I might be able to figure out a motion to mimic what they're talking about. And then have them start doing that so that you start isolating and figuring out what the problem actually is.
Right, and it's not always about pain either. Sometimes it's just differences in sensation. I still have one finger that I refer to as my rubber finger.
Sure.
It still feels very weird. And then how do you go about determining that it's really in the hand and not elsewhere? We have a number of people with brain tumors or brain stem tumors who've been told that they have carpal tunnel syndrome when in fact it was from that disturbance in spine.
Sure. There's a couple different ways to go about trying to differentiate that. One is a physical exam. Are there any other findings that would track to a more central process, proximal weakness potentially, change in voice, change in pupil size can be another one that can signal tumors in different locations. So you're observing for other things. The other thing in terms of carpal tunnel specifically, as a hand surgeon that I always do, is despite my physical exam coming up with the diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome, I'll still get nerve studies to confirm that there is compression across the carpal canal. The nerve studies done by a neurologist a lot of times will pick up symptoms in the neck, and then if I have findings in the neck, then I'll go ahead and get an MRI of their neck in order to make sure there's not a problem more proximal. And the MRI of the neck would actually screen from brain stem down to about C8.
Right, so hopefully you would pick up any abnormality around in there.
Yeah, that's the goal.
That's right.
I mean, there could always be exceptions, of course, but that's
right.
The goal.
So the big things were empathy and time is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, empathy, time, and understanding, knowing that the person sitting across the table from the physician is potentially scared or apprehensive or may be bringing some past experience they had with the doctor with them when they see me, and it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with their past experience and what's going on with them.
Right, right. So then what you brought away from your own experience was in part professional. It enriched your professional life. I'm sure it had an impact in your personal life as well and your interactions with other people. Can you tell us a little bit about how you felt around that?
Oh, sure. In terms of my personal life, I would say that caring more in the moment about what's going on, being present for the people that I love, expressing the feelings that you have at the times that you have them so the people around you know how much you care. Through the experience, just to give a little background, my wife's dad died from cancer when she was at a young age, teenager, 13.
Mm-hmm.
And it was lung cancer that he happened to pass away from. And during the course of my journey through this, there was a point where they saw something, a spot on my chest x-ray, and ended up getting a chest CT. So part of it going through here, she is sitting, waiting, supporting me when her husband, just a little bit younger than her dad was, or younger than her dad, is getting a CT scan for potentially a tumor in his lungs.
Right.
And so it's thinking about how your actions in your life affect the people that are around you, and it's stepping outside yourself, stepping out and noticing the other people in your life and realizing that life isn't all about you, it's about the people around you.
Mm-hmm. And that's a difficult thing to do when you're in the hot seat yourself, because the world tends to get very focal around you.
Sure, sure. And it's just, I guess part of it is thinking about the analogy that popped in my mind as you said that was just if you're flying on an airplane and that, you know, as you get ready to take off, the stewardess or the steward or the airline attendant says to you, you know, in terms of the oxygen mass, if we happen to lose oxygen, the oxygen mm-hmm. mass will fall down. And if you have a child or somebody with you that needs help, first put your oxygen mask on and then help them.
Right.
So I think in life, the analogy to me is, you know, taking care of yourself and putting your oxygen mask on and then looking at the people around you and doing what you need to do to help them with you being in a position where you can help. So it goes both ways.
That's right, because if you don't put your own oxygen mask on and you pass out trying to help the other person, then you're both in trouble.
Right.
So you do have to take care of number one, but also be sensitive to the fact that you're not the only one having issues here. It was
right.
good of you to realize that having lost her dad at that early age, that was all going to come back on her when she had to sit there and watch you go through a similar experience.
Right, and it's not to say that all the time I'm always present and thinking about those things. We all have challenges and at times lose track of how we want to do things, and it's just a matter of getting back in line with what you want to do and proceeding forward.
Right. So let's take a little break here, and when we come back, I'd like to ask you some questions about what you learned about the UK health system.
Oh,
so
sure.
We'll be right back after the following message.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Sayin'. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
Hi, we're back with Dr. C.K. Hirsch. And Dr. Hirsch, I understand that you did a project studying the UK health system. Could you share with us a little about that, please?
Sure. I had the advantage in college of being able to go, and it was a medical ethics program as well as a study of the National Health Service in Great Britain. And we spent 6 weeks in Great Britain, basically getting a chance to go around to different clinics and interview and learn from people in Scotland as well as down in London and England about the National Health Service, and get a chance also to visit some of the clinics and meet patients as well as administrators.
So what were your observations about that and how it's the same or different from our own system?
Sure. It was an interesting experience. At the time, the National Health Service was attempting to start saving money, and one of their strategies for saving money was within Great Britain, each region had their regional hospital or community hospital, and in some regions of Great Britain, it was almost, some of the urban areas, you would almost have a hospital, don't want to exaggerate it, but probably as close as about 6 or 7 city blocks. So there were a fair number of little community hospitals, clinics at different kind of levels of service. And what they wanted to do was to create a regional hospital where all these little clinic hospitals would become clinics or be shut down, and then they would the patients would be referred to a more regional center, a little bit more similar to what we have in the States. And that was quite a controversy because each person had grown up in their neighborhoods and wanted to keep their community hospital and didn't see a reason why theirs would have to be shut down as opposed to somebody else's. So there were a lot of community meetings during that time, looking at the different angles of that, and the government trying to figure out which ones to shut down and why. So there was that angle of it. The other thing that was interesting in contrasting it to our system is with the National Health Service, there were basically two queues or lines in Britain at the time. One was the kind of the government channel or government side, and then there was the private channel where if you had cash, you could pay for your operation with cash. If you didn't, then you waited in the queue or the line at the appropriate time to get it done. So those were two main observations that stand out from that period of time.
Right. I've worked with people in the U.S. and the U.K. with von Hippel-Lindau disease for a couple of decades now, and I've watched quite an evolution in both systems. Our system was pretty paternalistic in the 1960s and 70s, but picking up by the 80s, we were listening a lot more to patients, but that didn't really begin to happen in the U.K. until much later. I remember people in the 1990s in the U.K. telling me that, oh, if they asked questions of their doctor, they would probably be told not to come back. And whether that was true or not, it was the way they felt about it. You know, like, oh, no, you can't talk back to the doctor. No, the doctor sits to the right hand of God, and that's the way it is. But that's a lot less true now. Patients are a lot more willing to ask questions, to speak up, to question their doctor and ask for a second opinion. But it still is more difficult, I think, in the UK than it is here.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that distinction and that difference. It's so important for a patient to be able to ask questions and kind of gain their own information and push back sometimes about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Or ask for a second opinion. I think that's the other thing, that we all need to take some responsibility for that. If you're uncomfortable with the doctor for whatever reason or with the prognosis or whatever that you're given, it is your right to ask somebody else too.
Yeah, whenever somebody asks me for a second opinion, a lot of times the patient's kind of concerned about asking.
Mm-hmm.
And my attitude about it is, you know, fantastic. Go talk to somebody else and get more information. And, you know, if they have something to feed in or if you're more comfortable with them, that's a great place to go, because bottom line is you need to be comfortable with what's going on. It's not about the doctor and their ego. It's about the patient.
Right. I'm glad to hear you say that. And I've found that the better the doctor, the less likely they are to give you any problem at all about getting a second opinion. They're usually glad for you to go do that and validate it. And you'll usually come back because you've learned that this opinion, the first opinion, was probably the right one. But it's the doctors who have less confidence in themselves who will more likely get huffy with you.
You're exactly right. I think it speaks to the insecurity of the doctor and somebody that's angry or upset about a patient getting a second opinion.
Right. Tell me about your experience in the Navy.
Navy was a great experience. I was civilian trained, and after I finished my med school residency, and then I had the fortune to be able to stay for my hand fellowship and then entered the Navy. And I was stationed at Portsmouth Naval Hospital and got a chance to teach residents. So as a young surgeon, I had lots of hand patients to see. And the nice thing about the military is they're, you know, young, healthy patients and sometimes present with challenging problems, and also had the advantage of teaching residents and getting a chance to share my enthusiasm and experiences that I had in my training with new physicians and new orthopedic surgeons. At the time in the military, it was in 96 to 99 was when I was on active duty, and the you know, if you think back to that time, there really wasn't that much of a conflict like the Gulf War or any of those things. It was pre that period of time. But we still had different activities in helping other militaries around the world. So occasionally you'd get some interesting, you know, a soldier that had been in an interesting adventure and needed help of a physician and a hand surgeon. And great people. That's what I liked the best about the Navy, were the people that I came in contact with and the dedication that they had for this country that we live in.
So as a veteran, you must know now about some of the challenges that veterans are facing as they come back from the conflicts in the Middle East. One of the issues that we're all facing is the extent to which our people are being taken care of or not being taken care of when they come back. Do you want to comment at all on that?
Some of the details I don't know that I'm fully aware of in terms of some of the government funding, like privatizing some of the VA things that was recently talked about in the news. I don't know the details of that. From a value standpoint, here you have a group of people that have done what was asked of them for their country, have volunteered to serve their country, and they're coming back. And I think, as at least for me, what the United States stands for, we should be providing for them, you know, any service that they need and giving them access to the care that they need to take care of, because ultimately they gave kind of the most intimate gift, if you will, that they could give to their country, which is themselves and their own body.
That's right. So they've put their health at risk, and it seems like we ought to take care of them. And I think it's really shameful the way we're not taking care of them the way we need to. So I certainly hope that's going to get addressed shortly.
I do too. I hope part of, as we solve some of the challenges of healthcare, that, you know, the VA system is one that can be put in a position to be a model of what can go on elsewhere in the world, so that it's looked up to as opposed to the challenges within it.
Right. One of the other challenges in the military these days is that this is the only group of people in the United States that now has no protection against the misuse of their genetic information. So the armed forces are actively discriminating against people based on their genetics.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is. Well, especially with the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, it now protects everybody in the U.S. except the military. And the military still actively is discriminating against people based on genetics. So maybe you can help fix that. That's great. Well, I won't press you more on that. We should talk more about your book. Let's introduce it a little bit and tell us what motivated you to write this book.
Conquering the Game of Life is what motivated me in writing it was, as I went through some of my experiences, I've also lost both parents. And between the three, they all occurred within a six-year period of time, kind of every 2 years, something pretty significant was happening. And through that period of time, I started writing down stories and memories and experiences and realized that through them, there was a collection, and wanted to take my shot at writing a book and putting them together in a logical sequence to help other people and see if the experiences that I had in life by asking the reader questions, if it would, you know, help them. So I put it together and got some editing help and formulated the book, Conquering the Game of Life, which I use sports analogies to help the reader ask themselves questions and kind of look at their life as though they were playing a game, the game of life that we all are, and looking at who they are as a player, how they show up in their life, and asking questions about that. Kind of the rule book, how they play the game of life and the rules and questions that they ask themselves. And to some degree, our rules are formulated by the values that we take on from the people around us, our parents, our friends, peers, and sometimes stepping up and questioning those and formulating rules that serve us and help us, as opposed to kind of making us miserable in the game of life. And then kind of defining, you know, what is the game of life to you, what's success, and creating your vision of success, and then working towards that vision, and also the arena of life that we play in, which is off the Johari window, which is what we show about ourselves to others and what others notice about us. Then there's things that we keep hidden that other people don't see, which is kind of we create a mask or facade about who we are and keep something secret. And then there's our blind spot, where people may notice things about how we do things, but we don't notice them. And then kind of the arena where we play, where it's the last one, I guess, is the unknown to us and unknown to others, which is kind of an area for expansion of exploring who we are and expanding our identities and experiences.
Right, and you explained it in your book, but for the radio audience, we should probably explain a little bit about the Johari window. So this is a tool that's used sometimes in employee management situations or something. If you picture the bottom sash of a window and sort of divide it into four quadrants, then the rows are the parts that other people see about us, and the columns are the things that we see about ourselves. So as you say, there's one quadrant where we see it and other people see it, and that's all clear. And then the bottom right quadrant is we don't see it and nobody else sees it either.
Right.
So it's this
right.
set of unknowns. But then in the other two parts, there are things that we see about ourselves that other people don't know, or things that other people see about us that we don't realize. So, and all of those components are there. The fact that we or other people don't see them doesn't mean they're not true. But they're sometimes things that we need to take a look at and understand. You told one story about something that you didn't know that other people knew about you. Do you want to share that?
I'm blanking on the story right now.
Okay. let's see if I can remember it. But it was, you said you didn't have any prejudices.
Oh, yeah, thank you. In college, I was in a conversation with my roommate, and we were talking about prejudices, and I said, I didn't have any. And we were talking, and he challenged me, and he said, yes, I did. And I said, no, I don't. And we got into kind of an argument, and he said to me that, yeah, you do. It's people that, you know, from their kind of inefficiencies or intellectual challenges that that they're making you wait or the inefficiencies affecting your life. And so I said, I really don't think so. And we were at a store, and the girl behind the counter was kind of very methodical and inefficient in what she was doing. But he turned to me and he said, see, I told you so. And I was like, what? And he said, see, you do have prejudices, as I was getting frustrated with the person behind the counter. And sure enough, I did. So there's things that people notice about us that, you know, we may not want to admit or want to see, and if they point it out to us in a kind eye or a kind way, you know, you can look at it and decide, yeah, that's true, or you may look at it and say, well, I see where you're coming from, but no, this is actually what it is.
Mm-hmm. So it's useful to look at all those things. Do you find that with your experience with your patients, do you find that women are easier to talk with about these things, or is it just my prejudice, for example, that men are less likely to be willing to talk things out?
I don't want to offend anybody. I would say that that's a true statement. Women, just look in communication within society, women are much more about much more verbal and connection and communicating about what's going on in their lives and their mm-hmm. experiences and how they're feeling, where men in general have a tendency to shut that down and communicate more, potentially at times more directly, but not as detailed about what's going on.
Right. And I think one of the reasons that I really liked your sports analogies and like the fact that this book is written by a guy makes it more approachable for a lot of men. That you're sort of speaking in a language that a lot of men can refer to more easily than some touchy-feely stuff.
Yeah, thanks. That was part of the intent, was to make it so a guy could pick it up and read it and potentially open up some doors for them and look at their life in a different way, where if it was the typical self-help book, they might not. It was kind of funny. I'm in a book club of a group of guys, and at one of the first meetings I went to, they were all laughing about some of their wives reading Eckhart Tolle's The New Earth,
mm-hmm.
right? New Earth. And I'd read it, and I liked the book, but it was interesting hearing their comments about kind of it being a touchy-feely book, and they weren't interested in that, and we'd never do it at our book club. And it was interesting. So I hope this fits with the male audience, and the guys get a chance to read it and maybe get a chance to look at their lives and see how it relates to sports.
There's another really good book by a coach from Arkansas whose wife has Alzheimer's, and he's written a book for spouses of people with Alzheimer's, and it's a playbook for how to cope, how to get through days yourself, ways that you can support your spouse. And again, I think it's really wonderful that there are people speaking in guy language to men who are definitely going through these issues themselves and might benefit from hearing other people's experiences and getting a few hints along the way, because we all need a little coaching in a situation like that. It's new and different for everybody. And to be able to get some comfort and some hints for how things might go better, it would be useful for anyone.
Yeah. Playbook's a great idea.
Yeah. So let me take a little break here, and we'll be right back to talk some more with Dr. C.K. Hirsch about conquering the game of life. Hi, I'm Joyce Graff, the host of The Powerful Patient. For some 40 years, I've worked with people with von Hippel-Lindau disease, a tiny misspelling in one gene, the VHL gene, that causes tumors in 6 different areas of the body. Why these areas? What do they have in common? Interestingly, as we study VHL, we're learning about what causes cancer for everyone. The VHL gene is on the main superhighway for tumor development in many cancers. The answer we need for VHL is part of the answer we need for all. Won't you help us find a cure for cancer? People with VHL are donating their tissue and their blood to move this forward. Won't you please donate some money to help? Please give at VHL.org. We want to make VHL stand for Very Happy Life. That's VHL.org. Thank you. Hi, we're back with Dr. Hirsch talking about conquering the game of life. You have a chapter in here called Knowing Ourselves, and a really cute quote from Ferris Bueller, from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, saying, "Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop to look around once in a while, you could miss it." So tell us about knowing yourselves, and you discuss here an emotional triad, focus, language, and physiology, ways that we express ourselves.
Yeah, on that, it's around Tony Robbins with looking at our physiology of how we show up at, say, a particular emotional emotion, the language that we use in talking to ourselves and talking to others, and then the focus of what we're taking the particular experience to mean. So say if you take the physiology of being courageous, of thinking about how somebody would stand when they're courageous, how they would breathe, how their body would move. And, you know, most of us can think of a time when we're courageous, or if we can't, we can think of somebody who is courageous and how would they be standing and breathing. And then thinking about how would somebody like that be talking to themselves? What might they be saying, both to themselves and to others? And what words would they be using? And then kind of say that to ourselves, and then focused. If you had courage in this particular situation and you're courageous, what would you be focused on? What outcome would you be looking towards, depending on the situation? And through looking at those emotional triads, you can kind of see how you show up in life and maybe what triad you play in during the course of your usual game day, and then looking at, well, you know, what triad do I want to be playing in? How do I want to be showing up for my life? And working on those triads to help create the emotions that we want in our lives.
As a physician, do you use some of this to try to figure out what people are really thinking? I mean, for example, I'll read from page 39, people who tell you they're happy and yet sit slumped over, breathing shallowly, speaking softly, and looking at the floor, clearly appear more depressed than happy. Perhaps they feel socially obligated to portray themselves as being happy and upbeat.
In terms of within the practice, when people seem incongruent, which is where they're telling me one thing and I'm looking at them and it just doesn't quite fit, I'll ask questions to see if my comment that it doesn't quite fit is right. And then sometimes, depending on kind of the relationship, kid them and say, you know, hey, what's actually going on? It seems like what you're telling me doesn't quite fit with how you're sitting there. For example, perfect example, had a lady who was a nurse who needed a carpal tunnel release. And she had taken a step out of her career and was taking care of her mother, I think it was, or one of her parents, and had some other challenges in her life, wasn't working, was ending up kind of needing help in terms of a welfare kind of situation, and wasn't feeling proud about herself, which there really was no reason for that. And she was looking away from me and looking down, and I said, hey, what's going on? And she said, well, you'll be... Oh, I asked, what did you used to do for work? And she said, I don't want to tell you. And I said, you know, why not? And she said, well, you'll judge me, or you'll think poorly of me, I think is what she said.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out she was a nurse and had stepped out of her career to take care of her parents. And as I got the story as to why she wasn't working, I was like, well, look at what you're doing. You know, so many people don't take care of their parents, don't take care of their loved ones, and tried to reframe it for her of, you know, what you're actually doing is something to be proud of. You stepped up when your parent needed you to step up to take care of them. That's mm-hmm. that's not something to be ashamed about. That's something to be proud of. And it was picking up on the fact that the way she was sitting there as we were going through the paperwork before her carpal tunnel release, things just didn't quite match up and something else was going on. And so it was using it to pick that up.
Great. So those kinds of emotional things can also exacerbate the pain that we're feeling.
So much so. The longer I do the practice medicine, the more I think the perception of pain is real to all of us. I'm not, what I'm about to say isn't to belittle anybody that experiences pain, because there are things that hurt and there are things that cause pain. How we react to that pain has so much to do with kind of our mindset of how we're looking at it, the meaning that we're taking from it, and kind of how it fits in with our life and our identity. And those mm-hmm. things play a huge amount of our pain, perception of pain.
And pain is a message. So it's not just something to be covered up with medication or whatever. We really need to listen to our bodies and decide when to take action to do something about it.
I'd agree. Yes.
Yeah. You say here, the point is that pain in life, and I think in this paragraph you really mean emotional pain, but the point is that pain in life is there to teach us something. It's not a place to dwell in. Learn the lesson and move forward to the next part of our lives.
I think that's very true.
So tell me what prompted that in thinking for you.
Oh, I'm one of those people in the past that used to always ask my question, why does this happen to me? In terms of a cancer experience, you know, asking yourself, oh, why me? Why is this happening to me? And, you know, the brain's a powerful thing. If you ask yourself that question, you're going to come up with an answer. You know, potentially I'm not a good person, I did this wrong or that wrong, or, you know, this is my lot in life. You can come up with all kinds of
right.
answers. And if you ask yourself that type of question, you dwell in that kind of pain, if you will. Where if you look at the like a cancer experience of, okay, well, you know, this isn't what I would have chosen, but this is where I am. And with this situation, what can I learn here? Sitting where I am, what positive lessons can I take, or what signals can I get from this experience that will help me make my life better or richer as I move forward? And if you can find those lessons and then figure out ways of integrating that experience into your life and potentially even the healing process of moving forward, of teaching the lessons to other people, of sharing your experience to enrich their own journey in life. And
right, and most of the people who listen to this program are dealing with some kind of complex medical condition or disability, and it's very easy to take that experience and just sort of crawl into it with the grief, with the guilt, and so forth, and just say, as you just said, that this is my lot in life. But that's really not a very constructive place to be. It's much better to just move through that. I mean, it's part of the experience, the guilt and the grief. But if we get stuck there, that's the really poisonous part. We really need to move through it and beyond it.
Right. PTSD, some of the experiences of people treating those individuals have found that if you can help them figure out the lesson from the experience, learn the lesson, figure out how to integrate it into their lives, and then pass that lesson on, that they help breaks them out of kind of the traumatic cycle of PTSD. And it applies to any aspect of our lives.
And PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder?
Correct. Sorry.
Right. So it's after some horrible thing, some horrible accident, or the oncoming of a disability, or the military experiences that our folks in the Middle East are going through, being shaken up by a roadside bomb or something, can leave you with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right, any traumatic event.
Right, and there's a grieving process that we all go through when we've been through some of those things. But if you get stuck someplace in that grief cycle, then that's not a good place to be. The best thing to do is to move through it. And as you say, acknowledging what happened, understanding it a little bit, understanding that it wasn't your fault, and being able to move through that will help you get to a better place.
Right. Very well said.
So now you mentioned if you have children, how does it feel to be the parent that you know you can be? You want to tell us a little bit about that?
I guess part of it, a story to lead into that, would be having my kids at a restaurant. My wife was out of town, and I had both children with me. And it had been a long day, and I'd taken them out to a fairly nice restaurant. And we were eating, and things got a little out of hand, and I kept asking them to settle down, but it wasn't happening. And I got them out to the car, and I made a comment to them of, you disappoint me. And the look in my son's eyes, it was this hurt I hadn't seen before. And so it got me to think, okay, what did you just say? And I caught myself and I said, no. I love you guys very much. I said, who you are never disappoints me. I said, I really wish you guys would have listened and acted differently in the restaurant. And that disappointed me, but not who you are. You don't, in and of yourself, disappoint you. And that story is just leading into the language that we use with our kids is so important. And in life, each parent does the best they can, and I make mistakes. Every parent makes mistakes.
Right.
And it's as a kid looking at the mistakes that your parents made, or potentially what they did to you in extreme situations, and saying, you know what? I choose to do it differently. I'm not going to repeat those same patterns. I'm making a conscious choice. It may not be an easy choice at times, but I'm choosing to do things differently. My dad, I loved him dearly. He had at times a pretty intense temper, and at times in the kitchen would be cooking dinner and frustrated, and you'd hear the pans rattling. And as a 10 to 12, I remember cowering with the dog underneath the table because of the noise in the kitchen and how scary it was.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, I decided with my kids, you know, I'm never putting somebody through this with the experience that I'm having now. And now as an adult, I honor that the majority of the time, And at times, I can feel potentially the frustration that he was feeling and how he acted. And, you know, at times may raise my voice, but then catch myself and not get intense, as intense as what he did. And so that's me improving on the pattern that I was raised with. And hopefully my kids will improve on the patterns that I used to raise them.
Right. I remember one of the really good child-rearing books that I read when my son was little. It was called How to Parent by Fitzhugh Dodson. And one of the things he said that really stuck with me was, try to act out of your real emotion, not out of the surface one. Like your child runs out in the street and you go, and you start screaming at them as if you're angry with them. And you're acting as if you were angry. But in fact, that's not the real emotion that's going on. The real emotion is fear.
Right.
And you were terrified that your child was going to get hit by a car. That's what you need to communicate, and not the anger part, which is just a phony layer on top.
And behind the fear even is the deep love that you have for the child and couldn't imagine
right.
life without him.
Right, exactly. And somehow that's what we need to communicate with our children. I love you. I care about you. I don't want you to be hurt. And, you know, that was a terrible thing to do. But it doesn't diminish, as you said to your children, it doesn't diminish the love you have for them or the respect that's really there underneath. It's just, this particular behavior is not acceptable, dear.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, you talk a lot in here about focus. Using particular language choices as a key to communication and focusing what you really want to accomplish.
Yeah, to me, focus, I'm a tennis player, and focus to me, the best way to describe it is when you're playing a game of tennis, at times the ball seems motionless. You can see the banding on the ball. At times you can even see the number of, you know, like a Wilson 3 or a Wilson 4. You can even see that number when you're really focused on the ball and that's where all your attention is. It's amazing how slow the ball can be. There's other times where you're thinking about all the other aspects of your life and different things going on and your head's not really in the game. And the ball seems like it's flying by and no matter how hard you try, you can't seem to hit it. And the same thing applies to our life. When we're focused on the moment where we are, life kind of slows down and you can consciously make the choices that you want to make in that moment, where if you're distracted and your energy's in a lot of different directions, life seems to be flying by and more hectic than what it is if you stay focused. In terms of the language that we use, you know, you can go to the back to the question of why does this always happen to me, as opposed to asking yourself the question, what can I learn in this moment, or what's great about this, and being in a place of gratitude. In terms of language, part of it can be word choice, just simply, oh, this is the most horrible thing that happened to me, versus, you know what, this is an inconvenience right now, but I'm going to learn something from this. It takes on a total different feel to it.
Right.
And when you look at our lives, our memories are really a series of emotions that are stacked together in sequence.
Right. I know in the British language, instead of saying this person's a VHL patient, you would say this person is a VHL sufferer. And that always rankles with me. And I have one of the people I work with said, I'm not a sufferer. I'm a survivor. I'm not a victim. I'm a veteran. And just as you say, the word choices put the power in your space or not.
Right. You can alter something, the feel of something completely by how you say, as you said, victim versus veteran. I mean, that's a huge, at least for me, a huge emotional shift of where that person actually is.
You're not like lying in the roadway waiting for something to run over you.
Right.
You're actually taking some action here and conserving some power for yourself.
Right. And when we, you know, I love powerful patient because as you take the patient as a patient, if you look at it that, wait a minute, this is my body. I'm in charge of what's going on. I have control. And the healthcare resources around me are just that, the resources. I'm gathering information. I'm getting the studies that I need in order to try to get my body in the best shape and the best situation that I can be in. And it's choosing to take that power. It's a choice.
Right. And we need our physicians. We need good physicians in our life like yourself that we can team up with and gain from your knowledge and perspective and experience and the things that you know can be done. But at the same time, as you expressed in the beginning, we need to listen to the patient, respect the patient, understand that they're also an important part of this team. And without them, they're not going to get better.
Right. And I love team in terms of physician and patient, and it's not the physician's team, it's the patient's team. So as the physician, you're a team member on that particular patient's team, and you're there to provide information, potentially some coaching to help them see different aspects of things.
Right.
But the bottom line is the head coach is the patient. They're the ones that get to call the shots about what's going to happen.
Right. Right. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much, Dr. Hirsch. What would you say is the most important lesson from your book?
Most important lesson is in any given moment, we choose the life that we want. The power that God gave us to choose in any given moment is truly, once you realize that you have that power and can make your own choices of how you want to experience life, life's completely different.
Right, and when we wake up in the morning, we choose to have a good day or a bad day.
Exactly.
And some people wake up in the morning with a lot of pain, and they can either decide to wallow in the pain or to get on with their lives and try their best to put it in perspective. So, and I don't mean to trivialize the experience, just but we do have a choice to make for what we want to go through ourselves during the course of that day and also to put the other people around us through.
Right.
Right. Now, you have some exercises in your book also to help people.
In the back, yeah, with a series of questions, the questions I asked throughout the chapters, and then I realized I had a friend that read through part of it and suggested that in the back put some of the same questions in the back so that the reader can come up with their game plan of life. And so it's a kind of an exercise thing where you answer the questions, and when you finish, you end up with kind of your game plan of how you want to move forward with your life, from at least in that moment.
Great. Then we'll have some of the references that you and I have referred to during the course of the program will be in the handout that will go along with this show on powerfulpatient.org. So be sure to go there and look for the handout that goes with the show. And as you say in the back, don't take life too seriously. You will never get out of it alive. We all need to remember that. Do you have the book in front of me, in front of you?
I do, actually, yes.
Could you read us? There's a really nice quote on page 135.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
And this is a quote from Marianne Williamson's book, Return to Love, that was quoted by Nelson Mandela in his inaugural address.
Right. I love this quote. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We are all born to manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give others permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our fear, our presence automatically liberates others.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to leave with our audience before we go?
No, I very much appreciate sharing the time and them taking the time listening, and I thoroughly enjoyed spending time with you all this afternoon. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.
Everybody, have a great week. We'll see you next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Bye.